The Office of the State Historian is proud to present the New Mexico Digital History Project podcast series.
All right. Well, thanks. Thanks for coming. And it's such a great place to be talking. So this is a wonderful institution and a wonderful venue. I was just remembering last time we were here, we had a collection of historic photos from Jim Iyo. I think it was in this room, wasn't it? It was quite different. Was it downstairs? Were you here, Tomas? Probably. Anyway, it was very well attended, and there was a barrel full of Budweiser at the opening. I was looking for today. But so thanks for the introduction, Esteban. We will miss you and wish you the best, and we'll look forward to seeing what you do down there, which I'm sure will be great. This is, as Esteban introduced it, a collection of documents that's been around for about 300 years, and it's in the ones I'm focusing on come from the Plaza del Cerro area in Chimayo. And those, my mother here, Stella Chavez Usner, she's really a co-conspirator in this whole process. So if you have to blame anybody, we have to share the blame here. But much of the credit has to go to her as well, not only for helping me understand these documents, but for taking care of them. They've been in her care for several decades now, and she's done a very good job of caring for them. In fact, she gave them to me, the collection, several years ago, and I wisely gave them back, because I knew she was the best steward of them and could keep them more secure than I could. For now. So I wanted to start with this document just as a point of departure. This was 200 years ago, Gervasio Ortega returned from a trip. As you can see here, if you can read this, and you've got a job helping me. And he came back, this was in almost exactly 200 years ago. He came back in December of 1808 and found that in his absence, his father had died. And his stepmother had filed papers claiming inheritance of the of his father's estate for herself and her children by her second marriage. And she had left him out and all the children of the first marriage. So he came back and he was petitioning the Justice of the Peace in Santa Cruz de la Cañada, Juan Gallegos, to please revisit this issue and to make it right. That it wasn't right that while he was gone, and in fact, 8 days after his father died, the document was executed claiming that all the inheritance should go to his stepmother. So why is this document important or significant? Or is it important or significant? Well, I think it is. And I'm going to tell you today several reasons why I think it is and the other documents in the collection. I started working with this collection when I was doing my master's thesis back in 1989. And was wading through these documents. And as you can see, they're not easy to read. This is probably one of the most legible of them. And it's difficult to parse out their meaning. So it was a struggle getting through them. And as I was in the old archives, when they were downtown here, I was struggling with a document more poorly written than this one. And there was a person in the archives who came over, and he was more experienced than I was, and I asked him, I said, can you help me? I can't figure out what this says. And he said to me, why are you wasting your time with it? That these were country bumpkins, and this is an irrelevant document. It has no relevance to New Mexico history, and I'm not going to waste my time looking at it, and you shouldn't either. And it kind of set me back. I thought they were worth it. They were valuable and significant, but it made me sort of rethink the whole premise of spending a lot of time on these documents. And so I'd got enough out of them to write a little history of the settling of Chimayo for my thesis and for my book, Savino's Map, but I kind of left them aside and for several years. But my interest was really strongly rekindled in about 2000 when something happened that made me feel a sense of urgency about taking care of them and really taking a close look at them. And that was that in 2000 in May, the Cerro Grande fire started. My mother had all these documents in her home in Los Alamos, and she left and to come down to Chimayo to spend some time, and just on impulse, went back and got the documents and took them with her down to Chimayo. They were among the only, the few things that survived that fire. And, you know, it's so much, I owe so much to her foresight in rescuing them. So it just made me think how easily these could be lost after 300 years. And what a shame that would be. So, you know, Gervasio kept this for safekeeping. He had no idea how safe it would be kept, for how long. And I think there's value in really looking at them seriously, if for no other reason than they've been here this long and people have carefully handed them down for some reason. So we should, you know, give them some, you know, impart some value to them for that reason alone. But apart from that, as you get into these documents, you realize that they are little windows into a world. They're literally give you a glimpse of a place and time that's really not so distant, but is really far away in terms of the world we live in now. So this one in particular, just to take an example, if you look right up here, one of the things that grabbed me first of all was he was filing this document and he said, "En cuyo tiempo andaba yo en los cíbulos." For a long time, I really puzzled over los cíbulos. And then I realized that it was referring to Cibola, or which was a place, a fabled place of great wealth that really drew the Spanish to the southwest. And he was referring to going buffalo hunting or on the Great Plains. That's where he was when this document was, when his father died. He came back to execute his petition. So you start to read into them, you start to see that they're windows into a place and time, and they're also a Pandora's box of connections to stories linked to the history of New Mexico. On the second page, if you do one slide forward, it's a little harder to see in here, but just another example of how it leads you on different paths. He refers in here to La Quinta Parte, and he mentions that not only was this petition that disinherited him from his father's estate just wrong, but it failed to make reference to law number 8 of the Nueva Recopilación, which was a body of law that was founded in 1574, directing the way estates should be settled. So it just really intrigued me to be led down that path and have to find out what the new Recopilación was, and how did he know about that, this person in Chimayo, in this remote, isolated place? Was he just a particularly learned person, or was it general knowledge that there was this obscure body of law that you had to refer to when you're writing your last will and testament? So there's numerous ramifications in each document that I think are an invaluable way to learn about history. It's so much more interesting than being told. But to be able to go through a document and pick out these little gems that lead you down other paths. If we go to the next page, you'll see another document. This one is a petition for land by Luis Lopez. It was the oldest document in the collection, and it dates to 1706. And it's the first document relating to Chimayo after the Pueblo Revolt. So it's everything before the Pueblo Revolt was lost in the revolt. Very few documents survived at all, but this one is really significant because it's the first one, and he says some remarkable things that really connect to lots of historical facts, like, where is it here? He says he came back in 93, which was with Diego de Vargas, to apoblar nuevamente, to repopulate, and he found himself without land, and he found a piece of land, of royal land, without people on it, in the area of Chimayo. And whenever he mentions the king, this is a little bit of rubric that's interesting, del rey, it means that God may keep him. Every reference to the king is like that in the early documents. It kind of fades out in later ones. Anyway, he mentions some landmarks
an arroyo that divides the lands of Francisco Martin. Interestingly, he says it borders with an acequia that the Thanos Indians built when they lived in San Cristobal, and he mentions another arroyo. So you read this and you say, well, who were the Thano Indians? What were they doing there? Why did they abandon the place? And you begin to construct a history that relates to all of northern New Mexico, and this ties very directly into it. The Thano Indians moved into Chimayo in the absence of the Spanish after the Pueblo Revolt, and subsequently Vargas ran them out, and Luis Lopez, whose father had been killed during the revolt, or had died in El Paso, I can't remember. He was killed. His son came back and claimed land in Chimayo. So this is one of the few land grant sequences in the collection. There's about four documents related to Luis Lopez's claim, and subsequently the affirmation of that claim, and they sent out Roque Madrid, who was a very famous captain in Vargas's army, to go out and mark out his territory, and as was the tradition, was they threw rocks and pulled up grass and said, God save the king, and all that is commented on in this series of documents. So let's go to the next picture. This is just the second page, the back side of that document, and I just love this signature of Francisco Cuero y Valdez, who was governor at the time, right after Vargas had left. And it's his proclamation that he's approving the grant conditionally until Roque Madrid gets out there and can map it out and confirm it. How about the next one? So another reason that these documents are really valuable in my estimation is that they aren't abstract, they aren't isolated, they're related directly to a place, and to a place that's still on the map, that's still in existence, that many people know very well, and that's the old plaza in Chimayo, and this is a map drawn by Savino Trujillo that shows who lived around the plaza, a lot of the structures and rights of way, as he remembered it when he was a young boy, around the turn of the 20th century. So it's remarkable to have this collection of documents and find references to features in this map and to features that are still on the land today, landmarks, mojoneras, which were like corner markers for land, outcrops of rock, ditches, roads. And interestingly, Gervasio Ortega, whose paper we just saw, is listed here as owner of this house. And it says on it, first house in the plaza. He made that annotation. It mentions who his wife was. So there's a real direct link with a particular place, a particular house, and we can find reference in the documents to the aspects of that house that still apply, and still fit the description in the documents. Let's go to the next picture. And there is Gervasio's house, the one on the right there, just burned down about 2 years ago. The front wall is still standing. But the notion that it was the first house in the plaza is interesting, and again, you can refer back to the documents, as I will show later, and you can ascertain pretty clearly that from Luis Lopez there was a chain of ownership that led right to Gervasio and right to today through the Ortega line that probably did begin with this house. This is his document again. I was just going to point out things I already did. Next, and the back side of it. And Luis Lopez. And then they're also interesting just for what they tell us about the material culture, the daily lives, the way people lived in the plaza in the old days. And this is from a last will and testament of Maria Juana Ortega, and it's dated 1867. And I just, this is what my transcriptions look like. I take those documents that you just saw, type them in Spanish. I haven't translated them because translating is a monumental task that in some ways is not totally necessary because you can't translate a lot of it. They're written in Spanish legalese, first of all. It's often, you know how opaque English legalese is today to us, the way lawyers talk. They're written in that kind of language and they use archaic words and usages and they throw in Latin. And so a real verbatim translation is very difficult. So I've done transcriptions of all of them. And this one
she's just talking about her inheritance from her Francisca Aveta, and I just put it up here to give you a contrast between somebody of pretty modest means and somebody who had much more, many more material assets. And let's see. You can see right here, I have it translated in my notes, but Ocho Vegas Vigas, that's a typo on my part. A house 8 vigas wide, 5 varas, which is a little less than a yard and a half of a yard by the house, two apricot trees, 1 branch of an apple tree, or the sixth of the tree, 66.5 varas of land, and the third part of an ass. I love that. She got, I don't know which third it was, but probably. And she says that she received this to her contentment and satisfaction, and she had a witness at the bottom. So then we'll go on to the next one. You can see in this one, this is the last will and testament of Gervasio Ortega, the person we started with, and it's the first of two of his. I don't know why, 17 years apart. There seems to be a tradition in Spanish colonial New Mexico of thinking you're going to die for many years and not actually doing it. But here's how he spells his name, always with an X at the beginning, Gervasio Ortega. And here's another custom that maybe some of you can shed light on. Most of these wills and testaments start out very pro forma with a testament of faith, but they also almost always say, I find myself in bed with a mortal injury, but my mind is still together, I'm in all my senses, and I want to write my will and testament. Do you know, Esteban, why they all started out that way? I have a suspicion. I think they wanted that it probably wasn't legal to write your will and testament until you were dying, but they wanted to write it to get it all lined out, so they said, I think I'm dying, and wrote it. I don't know. Have you heard of this before? But finding themselves in bed with a mortal injury, is that part of it? I'd say more than half of the wills and testaments from Chimayo say that same statement. So anyway, he starts to list his belongings, and if you go down to the second page, and then the third page, you can see that they're quite extensive, and I made a little summary here of just a few of his belongings. Let me just see if I can find it here in my notes. Okay, well, first of all, one of the things they did very pro forma also in their wills and testaments was to list all their marriages and children. And with the men, it almost always was marriages because usually wives passed away in childbirth and the men just kept going with another woman. And so he lists all his children and his deceased wife. And I'll just read through some of his belongings to give you a sense for somebody of what somebody who was of means would have owned in this time period. He had 33 varas of land in El Llano de Romerío, 73 varas and a grist mill in La Puebla, a house 25 vigas wide, that's a pretty big house, a bucket for making honey, un cubo de miel, or maybe it's a bucket full of honey, a watering trough, an old box, a small table, a ladle, 2 small files, a china plate, 2 bultos of saints, 1 pound of bronce, which I assume is metal, bronze. From his parents, he had inherited 120 varas of land in Truchas and 10 more in Truchas, an old house, an old tree, 1 limb of another old tree, and 1 goat, all in Truchas. Through his marriage, he obtained the house that served as his home, which consists of 4 rooms, several other rooms on another house in the plaza, another old house next door to his home, a torreón, which is a watchtower, and another room in a house in La Cañada. From his son, he got a 3-room house and in Truchas through his acquisition, 292 varas more of land in the Milpa de la Sequia, and 79 varas elsewhere in Truchas, and 32.5 elsewhere in an orchard and an apricot tree, 2 more limbs of an apple tree, a syrup mill and all its equipment. He owned 7 oxen, 6 large and 4 small, 5 cows, 6 mules, 1 mare, 2 burros, 35 goats, 3 horses that wander outside of the plaza, 9.5 bushels of wheat, 4 almures of wheat, and 4 more from Gabriel Gallegos. So that's just a partial listing of his first, listed in his first will and testament. So I think he did succeed in his petition challenging his stepmother's claim, because he seems like he ended up with everything in the end. If you go to the next paper, and this is one that Dan Jaramillo here, a Chimayo historian, has studied quite a bit, The Last Will and Testament of Pedro Asensio Ortega, and this is a transcription of it here. And this one has been lost, apparently, the original. There's a copy in the archives, but my cousin had the original, can't seem to put her hands on it. This is really interesting to me because he describes a room in his house that he's dedicated to the patron saint of the plaza, and he lists everything in that room. Most of that stuff is still in there, just exactly as he described it in 1837. And he was also a person of great wealth. His will goes on and on and on with lots of property. And there's the oratorio, the chapel that he describes in that document. It's the chapel there. And it's one of the few buildings that remain on the plaza pretty much intact as it was in the 19th century. Okay, next. There's also in the collection a lot of documents not necessarily relating to the, you know, routines of will and testament and land conveyances and litigations. There's a lot of personal notes. And this one is a letter from Nicasio Ortega to his parents. And it's describing his experience in Silverton, where he's working in the mines. And it's just really interesting the way he talks about, the way he addresses his parents with such respect. I'm going to show this to my daughter, read translated for her. And the way he describes conditions up there and how much he, some of them describe their pay and the danger and friends of theirs getting killed. Next page. This is the second half of that with his signature. So there's a number of letters like this that have been kept, sent mostly back to Chimayo from people who scattered far and wide. Silverton, Colorado. Yeah. Silverton, yeah. That's how he spelled it, with a B. Yeah. What's that? Yeah, Nicasio was Andrew's grandfather. Yeah. And this one, why did I put this one? Oh, this is another letter home. This is from Juan Domingo Ortega, who was a brother to Gervasio. And he was describing a debt that he owed. He was staying up in Peñasco. And he's describing a debt he owed and how he's managed to arrange for repayment of the debt of 171 pesos. And he's telling his parents not to worry, that it's all covered, that they aren't going to be left holding the bill. And that's another thing I'd like to show my daughter. Anyway, these personal notes really lend a lot of insight into the lives of the people, into their families, into their relations, and into their labor life, how they made a living. This one is really interesting. This is one of the latest documents in the collection. It's from 1932. And this, as it says at the top, is a list of things that were spent or used during the illness of my mother. And I put my mama, cuando murió. And I just thought it was a fascinating little glimpse of this woman who was dying. And here's the statement about it. She says she died the first day of April 1932 at 10:15 at night. Simoncito Ortega died at the age of 82 years, 11 months, 23 days. And then it says, 12 días falleció. I think they meant falleció. She was in bed 12 days and left these six children. So here's the stuff that somebody was claiming credit for, all the stuff they'd spent taking care of her. And it included, it's an odd collection, a bottle of mentholatum, of course, a bottle of mustard. I don't know how that was used medicinally, but castor oil, lots of potatoes, sugar, lots of jars of jelly. And then at the very end, wood, nails, and payment for a carpenter. Sort of the final expense. It intrigues me also, why did people keep these lists and notes, and then why did they hang on to them, and some of them? I mean, this is just an odd sort of statement that is useful to us, but I wonder why they did it. Okay, next. This is just the handwritten version of that same document. There also were some personal, there is some personal correspondence in the collection, and this one is written to Señor Don Ramon Ortega, who's Jose Ramon Ortega. He was sort of the patron of the plaza. From his friend Alejandro Reed, who was a very learned man, brother of Benjamin Reed. And he's talking in here, he's thanking Jose Ramon for his help in the election, organizing votes. And they lost the election, but it's okay. Someday they're gonna do better. And he calls him a chimayocito and refers to him in very familiar terms. And it gives you a sense for the political maneuvering and connections and the fact that the plaza and Jose Ramon were very connected politically to state politics. Oh, this is a Jose Ramon. There's a number of, he heard cases as a justice of the peace, and there's a number of statements about him hearing cases. In this case, it's an assault that took place in a house in Chimayo, and he's calling for the detention of the person who pounded on the door, threw rocks at the door, demanded entrance, and he's demanding that he be detained. So there's a whole series of these that give a little insight into that part of the world. There was a couple of them dealing with murders that Jose Ramon attended. And this one, you know, there's a number of questions we've always asked, and those of us interested in the plaza, about its history that I look for answers in the documents. And one of them is, this is the one I'm thinking of, the idea of there being communal space inside the plaza. And there's a number of them going back describing the central part of the plaza as communal land for everybody that can't be sold or bought. And there's other documents that specify that there were rights of way around the inside of the plaza that needed to be maintained free of ownership, it couldn't be obstructed. And I find these all interesting because that notion has sort of gone out the window. It went out the window when the U.S. came in, did its small holding claim survey, and didn't recognize anything communal, and mapped right over these communal properties and assigned ownership. And ever since then, there's been contention about them, particularly the one, the idea of there being rights of way inside the plaza. Now, this one refers to the fact that, I just saw it now, that he forbids them from putting corrals inside the plaza. He orders them to keep them far away from the plaza so that they don't do damage to the crops inside. Why didn't I rotate that? Let's see. Para dentro de la plaza. Okay, this is just a land sale in early 1806, I think it is. He's saying, I'm selling a piece of land in the plaza to, I think it's Gabriel Ortega, but I don't include rights inside the plaza because that's patio común para todos, so communal lands for everybody. Next. That's just the second page of that. Another interesting document thrown in there, this is a list of the 15 children that Maria Petra Bustos gave birth to, Jose Ramon's wife, and it gives their birth date and who the padrinos were. And I just think it's impressive, the sheer quantity, the sheer numbers. But it also clears up a lot of genealogy questions that come up. Next. There's the second page. Third page, they used an old piece of paper from the legislature and wrote on it. They say that after her 15th child, Petritas was at her sewing machine and she said, "De aquí no más." And she laid down and died. Very soon. And then Jose Ramon never remarried. This one is another document about, can anybody read that to me? Oh, this is the one about the rights of way inside the plaza. And I thought this was great because somebody came to the mayor, to the alcalde in Santa Cruz, and they were filing a petition for that they had wanted to take possession of land in the Plaza de Santa Buenaventura. And he said that he wasn't sure about the property rights inside the plaza, so he said he sent people up there to call on the eldest of the community and ask them about these rights. A las más ancianos, que si no sabían cuántos eran los pisos, how much space was reserved for public right-of-way. And they agreed. The guy they talked to,
think he was an Ortega. Yeah, here's his name right here. Inijo, Señor Isidro Ortega. Okay, Doce Varas. So Doce Varas is about over 30 feet. And it was agreed that 30 feet inside the four walls of the plaza should be preserved for communal rights. This one is another question of land ownership in the plaza. I just scanned these today, so... Jose Grasso, do you remember this one, Mom? Cristobal. Oh, this one is about... Another question I had reading the documents was the idea of servitude, slavery, human trafficking, which was so common in New Mexico, trying to find some reference to that. And a woman who cataloged these documents initially translated this as one of the belongings of Una Navaja, N-A-V-A-J-A, as a Navajo woman as a servant in the household. And that's the only mention I found anywhere of ownership or servitude. But I'm not sure if that's what it means. I mean, maybe somebody can help me here. But Navaja de, looks like it says de barba, which doesn't make much sense. What's that? But it said, if it said barra, it would be a knife, a silver or metal knife. So although it was translated originally as a Navajo slave, I think it was referring to a piece of property, a knife. You think so? Navaja de barba. That would make sense, yeah. She had translated it as a bearded Navajo woman, which would have been a real asset in those days. Okay, let's see this, the next one. That was just the back page of that one. One more, Franz. Oh, okay. I guess that's it on the picture. Then I wanted to switch to the other. I entertain questions. Anybody have any questions? All right. Esteban asked me to repeat the questions. So. If there are any, yes. Well, there wasn't a school there. That's pretty clear. I don't think there was any school until public schools. I don't know what year they came in. The mission school came in 1900, and there was a public school there already. Yeah, the schools probably started after in the territorial days. But do you know, Dan, about the first school there at all? But literacy was very limited. But one of the surprising things about these documents to me is how literate the people were, considering their isolation. There a lot of documents are signed. It says, I asked so-and-so to sign because I don't, you know, or he asked so-and-so to sign because he didn't know how to write. And they often would leave a little cross as their signature. Many others also said, this was written, I'm writing this as a secretary of the governor or of some judge because there's no public scribe anywhere in this kingdom. No royal or public scribe anywhere in this kingdom. And therefore, I'm authoring it. So, literacy was fairly limited. And the language of these is really fascinating, the vocabulary and the spelling and the grammar. You know, it seems outrageously irregular. But if you look in American or any other documents from the 18th century, it was the same story. And I think most of the ones here were pretty elaborate and written. Some of the papers we have are just one page written very, very poorly. So there was a wide range. Any other questions? Beverly asked about literacy in New Mexico, by the way. You know, I think it took something like 3 years. It took about 3 years for correspondence to move back and forth. And I'm not sure if these needed to go that far. I mean, it was all done. The governor signed them in the name of the king. I don't think any of these particular documents traveled that far. I don't know. Okay, the question is, what do these documents in total really tell us? And that's what I'm working out. but what I'm seeing is that it's a history of a place, of a community that follows a thread of a single family, but that family has so many ramifications that it essentially is telling us about the history of a community. And what I find fascinating about it is it's a self-conscious history in a way, because these people were keeping these documents for a reason. Sometimes that reason is obvious. They wanted to protect their ownership of their land or have a piece of paper affirming their ownership of property. On the other hand, there's so many of them that seem to be saying, we just think this is kind of an interesting fact about our world today and we want to leave it for posterity. And that's what really intrigues me is... what was that sense of consciousness? Why was it so present in this community? Because as far as I know, these collections are pretty unusual, especially for one body focusing on one place and one family. And I may could be wrong. I've looked through the summation of the collections and seen there's many papers relating to administrative centers and to important families, wealthy families in Santa Fe and elsewhere. But I think it's unusual that there was this community so far removed from all that mainstream that saw fit to preserve its own history in a very self-conscious way. So we're getting a picture of how that community evolved since the resettlement after the conquest. And probably one of the most solid things you could extract from it if you really spent a lot of time is the fate of that single parcel that Luis Lopez claimed originally, because it basically has been cut up ever since, and these documents trace that same land all the way down to today. And you could see how that all took place and what was involved. But what's most interesting to me is sort of hearing the voices of people who are this far gone saying, hey, this is me, this is important. And to me, it feels like a great responsibility they've handed down to us to preserve these and protect them and do something with them. And what I hope to extract in total is a story of that place going back 1706. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Dennis? Well, a lot of that is, yeah, the question is, were there more documents relating to the experience of Chimayo people working in the mines in Silverton or Colorado? And there's not too many documents. There's a few that mention, I can think of two only. Can you think of more, Mom? That actually come from people in those places reporting on their experience. A lot of that survives in oral history, though, because that's recent enough that I've heard a lot of stories from people and recorded a lot. But the documents are fairly rare. There's another one from, isn't it also from Nicasio in Silverton? He talks about working for 2 weeks on a tailings pile and getting fed up with it and wanting to find other employment and working pretty hard. Juan Domingo, you mean? Juan Domingo. Yeah, maybe it was from him. But yeah, it's fairly thin on those kinds of reporting. No, Nicasio came back. Yeah, this is Andrew's grandfather. Yeah. There's a lot of stories. And I find it one of the things that in the documents I've looked really hard for that I haven't found is the history of that weaving story. For example, his grandfather's brother was my great-grandfather who stayed in Chimayo and started weaving. And this whole core of people, a number of people, came back when they saw that could be, they could make a livelihood out of that. And that transition, I think, is really interesting. And I looked in the older papers for what are the origins of that? You know, were people always weaving? Were they always selling woven goods? And not a single will and testament mentions a single weaving implement, with the exception of one time a mention of a cartha, which I assume is a carding implement. I don't know. But there was no mention of it at all through all those centuries, and there was no mention ever, and you correct me if I'm... Yeah, from Spain, there were a lot of weavers who came to Chimayo. Yeah, I think it was there, but it was... For some reason, they listed everything they owned, but they never mentioned a loom. They never mentioned a sheep, which is pretty essential for weaving. So it's kind of intriguing to me how it suddenly blossomed, and it must have been there, but... Well, they mentioned woven goods a lot as their possessions. Jerga and calcetines and all kinds of stuff. But yeah, they would, but they never mentioned the implements to do it. So it's a curious question. But I think one of the great stories is how this weaving thing took off and what an amazing feat it was. You know, in that day when the Depression hit especially, people were really hungry, and that a body of people there, a group of people, transformed what they knew into a livelihood is really admirable, really remarkable. Well, that's, yes, there are, I suspect there's many collections out there. One of the things I'd like to see happen with this, besides them going into safe permanent storage in the archives, is having scans of them made available for the museum in Chimayo and sort of get out to the communities this notion that these things they have in their closets are of great value, in contradiction to the historian who was working in the archives with me, who negated that. And it would be great to develop a much bigger collection and do comparisons of, across communities.
Right. I think that the whole notion that that there is a real valuable story to be told from these community documents is one of the messages that I'm discovering. Then I'd like to share with people is that, you know, they have phenomenal relevance in and of themselves, but also as part of the bigger picture.
Absolutely. Yeah. The question was I able to guess where Luis Lopez's property was or Francisco Martin? And the answer is yes. I have a pretty good idea. For example, they mention as a markation between the two properties is the Piedra Azul. I don't know if you've seen that. The Piedra Azul. And when I was first reading this, I asked my greatest source, my mom, what's this Piedra Azul? What's this blue rock? And she said, oh, the blue rock. It's right up there on the ridge. You know where it is, up by the water tank. And that sort of naturally, if you read in the documents how it falls with the boundary, that still fits. And I think he also mentions that one border of his property was the ditch that the Tano Indians took out. I think that's the Martinez ditch. And I think if we took the time to really work at it, it's obvious it was right around the plaza. That's pretty clearly. And I think we could get it much more clearly mapped out if we took the time and went out there on the ground with them. Another marker that they mentioned is a Alamo Grande, a big cottonwood by a ditch. Well, there's a lot of big cottonwood by ditches out there. But there's one in particular right by the museum. It's the biggest one by far. And I think if we looked at the documents, we may be able to figure out if that's that anchor point. But in general, I'd say it's definitely the plaza area where he settled. And Martin, I'm a little less clear on. I don't have his family history as well. All right, well, thank you all for coming.